Greetings, and welcome to First Impressions, a production of Marginalia Radio. I'm your host, Dave Kruger. Joining us is Christian Sonner, who recently earned his PhD from Princeton University. He has been accepted as a History Research Fellow at the University of Cambridge. Christian is the author of Among the Ruins, Syria, Past and Present, published by Oxford University Press in 2014. Christian, welcome to Marginalia Radio. How did you get interested in writing about the history of Syria?
As an undergraduate, I had studied classical languages and became fascinated in late antiquity. Late antiquity essentially spans the years 300 to 800, and among the significant things that happened during that time is the rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire and the rise of Islam, along with the formation of rabbinic Judaism. So it's a really significant period in historical terms. And ground zero for so much of late antique history is the Middle East, and in particular places like Syria, Lebanon. And so I had this intellectual itch that I wanted to scratch, and I knew that that itch would converge, so to speak, on Syria. So it was a place I had wanted to visit for a long, long time. And finally, after I finished my undergraduate studies at Princeton, I had the good fortune to go to Oxford, studying on a Rhodes Scholarship, did a degree that included heavy-duty Arabic study, and at the time received wisdom said there are one of two places in the Middle East to go to acquire good Arabic. One was Cairo and the other was Syria. And so in a sense, my studies converged with my long-term interest and passion in this country, and I found myself in Damascus. And so the book is a product of these two inputs. On the one hand, the lived experience, what was life like for me living in Damascus, visiting Syria in the years before the war, paired with my historical passion for the country, the deep history of the country, not just contemporary events, 20th century, but the history of Syria as it extends back to Roman times, Byzantine times, early Islamic times.
Could you give us some background about the current civil war in Syria?
The civil war in Syria is both a local event in the sense that it reflects conditions that very much Syrian issue, but significantly manifest wider regional trends and global trends. So Syria's civil war began in March of 2011 when protests first arose in the southern city of Deraa in the south. But it's important to understand that initial uprising within the context of the Arab Spring, which had already come to the fore in places like Tunisia, Egypt, and elsewhere. And the Arab Spring, a moment that is in fact not very far from us in time, but which feels very far from us in spirit, was essentially a movement of popular protest aimed at toppling long-standing autocratic regimes that had controlled these Arab states, essentially police states, that had created stability at the cost of great civic freedoms. Initially, it seemed that this Arab Spring was going to be confined to, again, places like Tunisia, places like Egypt. Very quickly and perhaps inevitably, it spread to Syria, where, as in these other countries, it very much emerged as a response to years of Ba'athist rule, the Ba'ath being the Arab Socialist Party that had been in control of Syria on and off for many decades now, under the guidance of a leading family, the family President Hafez al-Assad, who ruled from 1970 until 2000, and following his death, his son, Bashar al-Assad, who remains the president of Syria. It's within this context that we have to understand the rise of the Syrian civil war and what began essentially as a movement, popular protest, aimed at upholding the dignity of the people, pushing back against these repressive states that jail people, that censor the public, that deny many of the basic freedoms. That movement quickly soured as it became increasingly violent, as sectarian identity asserted itself as an essential element. And now, 4.5 years on, what began as this Syrian incarnation of the Arab Spring looks very, very different, not merely in opposition versus the Syrian government, but we have the Syrian government as merely one of a variety of players on the ground that include groups like the Islamic State, other Islamist groups operating on the ground, so-called moderate nationalist groups, which have been a shrinking portion of the resistance. So these are the historical origins of Syria's civil war.
How have Western observers, particularly journalists, misunderstood the civil war in Syria?
Although the Syrian civil war manifests factors on the ground that have been percolating past, I'd say, 30 to 40 years, really to understand the true arc of the conflict, we need to have a much longer-term perspective. And by that I mean not just events in the 20th century, but events that go back to the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, the formation of nation-states across the Levant, indeed the rest of the Middle East, and even beyond that, into the world that I know best as academic, the world of late antiquity, the world of early Islam, in which many of the distinctive ethnic and religious groups that are still factors in Syrian society today came to be, settled in their distinctive parts of the country, came to interact with each other and form these coherent identities. And so it was out of a desire to see an intelligent and accessible take on history injected into the current events reporting. That's what drove me to do this book. The other thing that I would say that journalists miss, and it's not in this instance specific to the Syrian civil war, I think it has to be characteristic of many conflict zones around the world, that there is a tendency to lose track of storylines. Lose track of storylines as they cease to be interesting to readers, and to lose track of storylines as they come to be eclipsed by ever greater and greater tragedy. A great example of this is the rise of the Islamic State. If you want to read about the Syrian civil war in a mainstream American newspaper today, what you will usually get is reporting about conflict between the Kurds and ISIS, between the Syrian government and ISIS. We don't find front page reporting to nearly the same extent on what remains the frontline humanitarian tragedy, the displacement of millions of people, the loss of entire generations of Syrian youth who live in squalor in refugee camps. And so this is a frustration of emphasis that, on the one hand, Syria is more exposed than at any other point in the past, I'd say 20 or 30 years, to American readers, to readers in Western countries. But at the same time, we're not necessarily getting exposure to the storylines that affect most Syrians on the ground. And this is obviously not to diminish the threat posed by ISIS, but that is to say that the stories of the smaller people, the people who are voiceless, the people who do not wield guns, who do not wield the Twitter accounts and YouTube videos, that these get swallowed in the reporting. And this is a great tragedy.
You say that prior to the civil war, Syria had a reputation of being a non-sectarian paradise where many religious and ethnic groups lived together without conflict or tension. However, you challenge that characterization. Could you introduce our listeners to the main groups in Syria and how they related to one another prior to the civil war?
So when people talk about Syria as being a mosaic of sects, what they're referring to is the existence of a terrific amount of diversity, basically not found in many other parts of the Middle East. Syria's population is majority Sunni Muslim. Sunni Muslims constitute the majority of Muslims worldwide, and they constitute the majority of the population of the Middle East writ large, at roughly 70 to 75% of the population. The much fabled diversity of Syria lies in the many small communities that have existed there over the many centuries. The leading minority community in Syria are the Alawites. The Alawites are essentially practitioners of a form of Shi'i Islam that over the centuries mixed with other indigenous religions in the mountainous northwest of Syria. The Alawites, despite having been a marginal group throughout much of history, muscled their way into the center of Syrian politics, of course, the 20th century, and indeed the ruling family in Syria since 1970 has been an Alawite family. The family of President Bashar al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad, are Alawites. And so this is the essential fault line in Syrian civil war, is a perceived imbalance of power between the Sunni majority and this Alawite minority, an Alawite minority that has a disproportionate share of the political power in Syria. There are other communities worth mentioning. Christians are an ancient, very historic part of the population in Syria. It was in Syria that followers of Jesus were first called Christians, as the Acts of the Apostles tells us, the book in the New Testament. So these are very, very deeply rooted communities, 5 to 10% of the population, a number that has dwindled significantly as a result of civil war. Other communities include the Druze, Ismailis, Kurds. Jews used to form a significant part of the population, but as in other Middle Eastern countries, they have disappeared in Syria over the course of the past years to the point that they are essentially non-existent today. The existence of this diversity did not in and of itself entail the existence of a sectarian culture, and this is one of the big points that I want to make in the book. Diversity does not equal violence. However, when exposed to certain pressures from politics, from social life, the wrong pressures often does give rise to deep tensions that can spill over into violence. And so one of the recurring conversations that I had as a young American living in Syria before the civil war was that this country was different from its neighbors. Many Syrians looked to Lebanon, for example, a tiny country that Syria literally envelops on its western edge, which boasts a similar type of religious and ethnic diversity, but which had been scarred by a horrible 25-year civil war that saw these different sectarian communities pitted against each other, tore the country apart very famously. Syrians looked at the Lebanese situation and could rightfully say that these same tensions had not affected their society. I mean, they can be very proud of that. And so when people spoke about Syria as being a super sectarian paradise, that is to say, a place that welcomed its diversity, that did not allow its diversity to overcome it, that was true to some extent. One of the points that I try to make in the book, the sectarian tensions that we have seen emerge in the context of the past few years also did not emerge out of nowhere. So while Syria indeed was not Lebanon, there were certain unspoken tensions in society that I think have given rise to the tensions and some of the violence that we've seen recently. And a lot of this stems from this essential imbalance of power between Syria's Sunni majority and this Alawite minority that has essentially run the show for the past few decades, and the outsized role that minority communities have played as a result. The Alawites were very deliberate, very assiduous about cultivating the support of other minority communities. And so inevitably, religion entered political life, and we see the consequences of that to some extent in the context of the present civil war.
Could you give us a couple examples of how historical sites have layers of meaning in places like Syria? How do politics shape how these sites are understood?
So the classic archaeological and historical site in a place like Syria is a site that has been occupied by successive civilizations down the years. A great example is the Umayyad Mosque in the center of Damascus's old city. It's arguably the most famous historical monument in the entire country. It graces Syrian currency. Once upon a time, it was on tourist brochures that Syrian government would send out. It is the most recognizable monument in the entire country. Its story is typically Syrian. The site where the mosque stands was home to a succession of pagan temples, the last of which was a very great Roman temple dedicated to Jupiter. When the Roman Empire embraced Christianity as its official religion, the temple was destroyed, converted into a basilica dedicated to St. John the Baptist. According to tradition, the head of John the Baptist resided within that basilica at the heart of Rome, Byzantine Damascus. And then when the Muslims conquered the city in the 630s, initially there was a period in which Muslims and Christians worshipped side by side in that Byzantine church. Essentially, there was a prayer alcove that was given over to the small but ever-growing Muslim community. Within a few decades, that situation remained untenable. At the time, Damascus was the seat of the Muslim empire, an empire that stretched from the Atlantic coast of Morocco all the way to the Hindu Kush. Invariably, the situation became bothersome, probably a source of embarrassment, and the church was razed, and it was replaced by the mosque that continues to stand today. And so this is a very typically Syrian, very typically Levantine arrangement, which we can see very vividly, layers of pagan that give way to layers of Christian, that give way to layers of Muslim in a single site. It's also interesting to see how in the context of the present civil war, such historically pregnant monuments can take on new political meaning. And to give you a specific example, the Umayyads, the first dynasty in Damascus that constructed this mosque, left a range of other monuments, palaces, hunting lodges across the deserts of eastern Syria and Jordan. There's a very, very famous one in the desert east of Damascus. It has featured prominently in videos done by jihadi groups who essentially understand their effort to topple the government of President Assad as an attempt to restore a Syrian Muslim civilization, to wrest control of Syria away from the heretical Shiites, those they perceive as heretical Shiites, and instead essentially restore a second Umayyad golden age. And they do so filming against the backdrop of these great Umayyad ruins from the 8th century. And so fascinating to see how these monuments are on the one hand great sources of unity. These are monuments many people have been proud of over time and I think continue to be proud of, but also interesting to see that how they can be manipulated, how they can be controlled and used to the benefit of different political messages in tense time.
Christian, could you walk us through a bit of your book and give us a bit of an outline of the key historical periods in the history of Syria?
There are many parts of Syria's past to choose from if we want to understand its present. But if I could zero in on two, it would be the early Islamic period. Period that begins in the 7th century with the Arab conquest of the Middle East, Syria's replacement from being a Byzantine province of a Christian empire based in Constantinople to being the heart of a Muslim empire based in Damascus, and then over subsequent centuries, other capitals, including Baghdad. And then secondly, the 19th century, and specifically the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And why do I zoom in on these two moments? Well, I think in order to understand the cultural and religious diversity that Syria lives with today, we have to understand the manner in which these various religious communities came to be and came to interact in the early medieval past. Christians are deep in the history of Syria. They were there for centuries before the rise of Islam, and indeed Christians constituted the majority of the population in Syria, as throughout the Middle East in general, probably for another 500 or 600 years after the rise of Islam. So these were not minority communities throughout much of Syria's post-conquest history. As Christianity carried on in the Levant, Islam itself took root. Islam, much like Christianity, is terrifically diverse unto itself. And so from those very earliest years, there are sectarian cleavages, cleavages that give rise, for example, to the Sunni Shiite communities, along with a host of others, including the Alawites. And so in order to understand the sectarian configurations of Syrian society, we have to understand how these communities are very much a story from the early Middle Ages, from the Central Middle Ages. Now, to understand how the existence of this diversity came to be mingled with Nadi politics, we have to understand the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was, of course, the Turkish-speaking empire that ruled much of the Middle East, much of the Balkans, much of North Africa from its capital in Istanbul. In the 19th century, this empire began to falter, and there were reforms that the empire witnessed, reforms that, on the one hand, granted a suite of rights to minority communities, especially Jews and Christians, that they had not enjoyed throughout history. So that was certainly a positive development for many of these smaller religious communities in the Middle East. But on the other hand, many of these reforms caused deep civil unrest. And so as historians tell it, the 19th century was also the moment in which religious identity took on a political valence. And so in a sense, not that there is a direct line either between the world of late antiquity and the present, or between the world of the late Ottoman Empire and the present. There are certain events in Syrian society that percolate over time, and which in a sense have culminated with certain events that we've seen.
So what are your hopes and fears for the Syrian people in coming months and years?
The rise of ISIS has changed the calculus on the ground in big, big ways. What began as essentially a conflict, an autocratic, repressive regime versus an opposition clamoring for human rights, self-determination, that tidy axis has been exploded by a proliferation of groups that seek to topple the Syrian regime, but who also harbor a range of other goals. And the foremost of these groups that have upset this axis is ISIS. ISIS is a group whose origins are not in Syria, but rather emerged of the maelstrom of the U.S. invasion in Iraq, a group that was essentially on life support in recent years, but which very shrewdly profited from the bedlam inside of Syria and used the chaos of Syria's civil war to incubate, to regroup, and to regrow. And so ISIS's entrance is a major factor in the conflict, has made it very, very difficult for people inside of Syria to know in which direction their country is going. Is it going to end up in the hands of Syria's government, what's been in power for the past 40 years? Is it going to end up in the hands of a loose coalition of Islamist and nationalist groups whose notional goal at least remains the toppling of the Syrian regime? Or is it going to end up in the hands of ISIS, a group that certainly is a participant in Syria's civil war, but whose goals are much, much more expansive than merely toppling the regime in Damascus, but instead expanding a proto-state across the entire Middle East, drawing in people from far and wide. So this has made the Syrian civil war extremely difficult, and frankly, has made it a great challenge to write about in the midst of, you know, I'm accustomed to writing a form of history where the interpretation of the past is always up for debate, but the past is over, and it makes the story easier to tell. In a sense, what we are dealing with today is an extremely fluid and extremely dynamic situation in which history is racing ahead and changing at a pace that is beyond the skills of a historian or a journalist or anyone really to be able to analyze properly, to know where it's headed. And so ISIS has been that black swan in the midst of all this that Syria watchers like myself, in the midst of writing my book in the past few years, could not have anticipated. So I do not feel particularly positive about what is going to come in Syria. I have a particular interest as a historian and in the state of Syria's cultural patrimony. Syria is home to a terrific diversity of historical sites that range across civilizations, that range across the centuries. This is Syria's patrimony, but it's also world patrimony. It's a patrimony that is arguably more variegated, richer than even what we find in a place like Egypt. Place that probably comes to mind first for American listeners in Europe, when they think about art and architecture, archaeology in the Middle East. At first, this heritage was under grave threat, essentially as a result of recklessness and opportunism. The idea that the battle was spreading to all corners of the country. All corners of the country are populated with these incredible ruins, these great treasures of the past. And so cultural heritage was collateral damage of damage that was happening on a massive scale everywhere in the country. The arrival of ISIS has changed that. ISIS not only engages in reckless destruction of historical sites like other parties in the conflict, ISIS introduces an additional poisonous element in its ideology. Its jihadi Salafi ideology essentially justifies the destruction of historical monuments, works of art. That narrow reading of Islamic history, of Islamic texts, it can regard as pagan. And so it has a theological and an ideological justification for destroying these things. Now, ISIS is also not above opportunism. And so one of the great streams of revenue that ISIS has, along with things like contraband oil, ransoms, is also the trade of illegally looted antiquities. So we're headed into a world in which the state of cultural heritage in Syria, the great incubator of civilizations in the Middle East and indeed throughout the rest of the world, much of this stands to be tragically lost as a result of the past few years of fighting, and in particular, as a result of the rise of ISIS.
Finally, what do you want your readers to take away from this book?
My goal in writing the book was to convey the terrific diversity of peoples, of cultures, and religions that exist in Syria. They have existed in Syria and indeed many, many parts of the Middle East for a long, long time. I think long before there was a Syrian civil war, readers in America, readers in Europe had a tendency to look at the Middle East as a cultural monolith. And so the book is an attempt to disprove this impression. And in the midst of the present civil war, a civil war that has critically threatened many of these small, these fragile communities, a war that has also threatened cultural heritage, I wrote the book as a testament to all that stands to be lost if these communities, if these relics of the past disappear.
With that, we will conclude this episode of First Impressions. Again, the book is Among the Ruins, Syria, Past and Present. Thanks to Christian Sonner for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. Have a great day.